This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. Well, in the last few years, our culture has been bombarded with a view of sexuality and human identity that's absolutely at odds with the biblical worldview, you might have noticed. And we see it in the stated goals and accomplishments of the radical homosexual and transgender movement. And we also see it in the arguments made by pro-abortion and pro-euthanasia activists. And at root, according to my next guest, these moral issues are driven by a hostility toward the body and toward biology. Joining me today is best-selling author and speaker Nancy Pierce. She serves as professor of apologetics and is scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. She's also editor at large of the Piercy Report and a fellow at Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. And she is out with a new book. We're going to talk about Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. Nancy, it's so great to have you here. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's wonderful to have you. Now, I'm curious why you think it is that human life and sexuality have become, as I think you put it, the watershed moral issues of our times. Why this issue?
I think it has a lot to do with people finally figuring out some of the implications of what secularism means. People tend to live out the consequences of their worldview. And this is one of the things we need to understand is if we're trying to figure out where a culture is moving, instead of always being reactive, instead of always being on the defensive, we can get ahead of the game if we say, well, look, what are the presuppositions? What are the basic worldview assumptions? And then we can work out where they're going to be heading. For example, the sexuality issues come right out of a Darwinian materialistic view of life. Ever since the scientific revolution, many people have decided that the material world, that nature has no particular purpose, that it was product of blind material forces, and that has no higher meaning or dignity. The human body has been reduced to just a collection of atoms, cells, and tissues, no different from any other chance configuration of matter.
Right.
And so what is the implication? The implications are being worked out in our day. It is that our bodies convey no moral message. They give no clue to our identity. They have no inherent purpose that we're obligated to respect, that we're the ones who decide what's right or wrong, that we're the ones who decide what moral course we want to take, so that morality has been reduced to subjective choice. Let me give you one quote that just really crystallizes this. This is the feminist lesbian Camille Paglia. I'm sure you know her.
Yes.
And she defends her homosexuality by saying, and this is a quote, "Fate, not God, has given us this flesh. We have absolute claim to our bodies and may do with them as we see fit." So the idea is, if God did not give us our bodies, then they have no inherent purpose, no inherent dignity, and we're the ones who use them as we see fit.
Mm.
And it's that's the logical conclusion of a Darwinian materialist view of nature. And now we're seeing people work out that conclusion in their personal lives.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And yet immediately what sprang to mind when you were reading that quote was the fact that this is the same lesbian activist who recently was deriding transgenderism and saying it's child abuse to give children hormones and try to turn them into something they're not. So she's a little inconsistent when it comes to what her worldview is regarding sexuality and what the identity of a person is, although I think she's absolutely right on the latter issue.
Except I agree with you that she's inconsistent, but there is a logical link, and that is if she says I can be lesbian because my body does not give me any clues to my identity, well, that's what the transgender person is saying too.
Yeah.
The transgender person is also saying, they're just taking it the next step.
Right.
They're just saying we should disassociate our biological sex from our gender, that the authentic self is strictly a matter of inner feelings. So that kids down to the age of kindergarten are being taught that their body is irrelevant to their identity.
Right.
That the body doesn't matter. All that matters is your inner sense of self, your inner feelings. Or put it another way, if a person senses a disjunction between mind and body, the mind wins.
Yes.
But why accept such a demeaning view of the body? It's radically dehumanizing. If our bodies don't have inherent value, then that's a key part of our human identity that's being devalued. So the transgender narrative is as estranging people from their own body. And that's the connection between the two movements.
That is really good. That's very, very true. And yet it's kind of ironic because on the one hand, you have this celebration of the freedom to do whatever you want with your body. But that freedom is also leading not only to the devaluing and dishonoring of your body, but even the destruction of your body. In other words, if you have somebody going in and having this radical life-altering and body-deforming surgery, you're hurting yourself. And yet at the same time, you're thinking, I'm being totally self-actualized. There's a paradox there.
It is a paradox. And in fact, what you're seeing now is the real cutting edge, interestingly enough, is that I can be transgender and not change my body. There's a trend right now towards saying, I do not have to change my external appearance at all. Notice that some of the transgender, the SOGI laws, sexual orientation and gender identity, SOGI, they're called. Many of those laws are saying, you can claim a transgender identity even if you have done nothing to change your external appearance.
Sure.
So the idea being that this is actually part of for many activists, this is refusing to change your appearance is part of a deliberate strategy to eliminate the binary categories of male and female altogether. There's an activist who wrote not long ago in a homosexual magazine called The Activist. Advocate. And she says the very purpose of not changing our external identity is that if I look masculine, but I declare that I belong in the women's restroom, then we are going to challenge the entire underlying binary distinction altogether.
Right.
And so that's the end game, is to destroy the binary distinction altogether.
Exactly. But this goes back to a Gnostic worldview, right? Because we're talking about secularism, but there's nothing new under the sun. This is part and parcel of Gnosticism, isn't it? Saying that you are a special being and the body is not important, that sort of mentality. Where do you find, if any, the parallels between ancient Gnosticism and what we're seeing now?
Yeah, I love this. This is it's helpful, I think, as Christians to realize this is not new. The Christian church has faced this before. In the early church was born into a culture that was dominated by world-denying philosophies like Platonism and Gnosticism. And Gnosticism treated the world as a place of death, decay, and destruction. Hmm. It was a source of evil. In fact, Gnosticism said there were many levels of gods, and it was the lowest god, an evil god, who created the material world. Because, after all, no self-respecting God would get his hands dirty mucking about with matter. So in that context, Christianity was revolutionary. It taught that it was not a low-level God. It was the supreme God, the highest God, who created the material world. And what's more, he pronounced it very good.
Yes.
But an even greater scandal at the time was the incarnation, the idea that God himself would enter the material world and take on a physical body. That is the ultimate affirmation of the dignity of the body. And at the end of time, God is not going to scrap the material world as if, oops, I made a mistake. Right? He's going to renew and restore it.
Yes.
He's creating a new heavens and a new earth, which was affirmed right from the Apostles' Creed, the resurrection of the body.
Amen.
So this is an astonishingly high view of the physical world. There's nothing like it in any other philosophy or religion. So we really do have the tools in the biblical worldview to go beyond a negative message, which is true but not complete. You know, it's a sin, it's wrong, don't do it, thou shalt not. But we can start deploying positive arguments, showing that a biblical ethic is really more affirming, more positive, more attractive, more appealing than any secular ethic.
Well, I love that. And that's one of the things I want to be able to do as we continue to talk about Nancy Piercy's new book. It's called Love Thy Body. We're going to go to a very quick break on Janet Mefford Today, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. Socialism is being purposely dressed up in Christian choir robes by once trusted and very influential church leaders. Their gatherings are growing in numbers as they shelve the true gospel and replace it with a false one known as the social gospel. What is this agenda to undermine the influence of Christ across the world? And whatever happened to powerful biblical Christianity? Noted producers Judd Saul, Trevor Loudon, Curtis Bowers, and Pastor Kerry Gordon of Cornerstone Church have joined forces to create enemies within the church, a hard-hitting international documentary that will reveal the plans and the players behind this movement and shine a bright light of restoration and hope upon Christ's church. We encourage you to partner with enemies within the church and help them complete this important project. To learn how to help and to stay updated about the film, go to enemieswithinthechurch.com. And while you're there, be sure to enjoy a sneak peek of the movie. Go now to enemieswithinthechurch.com. That's enemieswithinthechurch.com. Enemieswithinthechurch.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We are back on Janet Mefford today and so glad to be talking with Nancy Piercy, professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. Her latest book, Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. And I agree so wholeheartedly with you, Nancy, that we not only need to go negative in a way when we are trying to do the polemics of saying to the secular worldview, the materialists, that you got this separation of body and mind wrong and we need to correct that with the Christian worldview, but we need to give these positive arguments. But going back to this dualism that you describe in the book, talking about the pervasive worldview of our day driving these attacks on life and sexuality as being dualistic, can you explain this, the separation of the body and the person, and what the mindset is of people who are engaging in this way of thinking?
Yeah, I think let's take abortion because it's perhaps easiest to see there. Most secular bioethicists today agree that the fetus is human from conception. The data from genetics and DNA is just overwhelming. The fetus is human from conception. But why don't we grant it legal protection then? Well, because the same bioethicist will say it's not a person. Until it becomes a person, it's just a disposable piece of matter. It can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be used for research. It can be tinkered with genetically. It can be harvested for organs. You can sell the body parts for profit. And then you can dispose of it with all the other medical garbage. So if the fetus can be human at one point, but not a person until sometime later, then obviously these are two different things.
Right.
And there's a word for this, actually. It's called personhood theory. And you can see how it implies a very dualistic view of the human person. It says that on the one hand, you can be a fetus and then later become a person. In other words, what is the human being then? It's been split apart into this dualistic dichotomy. So when we talk about a Christian worldview, we're saying we reject that dualistic, fragmented view of the human person. We see the person as, we see the fetus from the beginning as a person with all the inviolable rights of a person. And as you see, the thing is, we've got science on our side. That's the irony here, is that the secular person claims to be scientific, but the change from being a piece of matter to being a person with rights is a momentous change. And there's no transformative point that science can detect objectively. There's no place at which you can say, Here, the fetus was a non-person, and here it has been suddenly transformed into a person.
Right.
So the definition of personhood is non-scientific, non-empirical. It's completely private, subjective, and arbitrary. It is really the pro-life view that's based on science. Pro-lifers don't, we don't argue about the value and worth of life until science has first told us when life exists.
Yeah.
So it's the pro-life arguments today that are based on science, and the pro-abortion arguments are actually based on this private, subjective, essentially postmodern view of personhood.
It's so true. And they keep moving the goalposts, because wasn't it the case back during the time of Roe v. Wade that there were those who said, if you could prove that that glob of cells was actually human, then we would change our viewpoint on abortion, because we certainly don't want to be in the business of killing people. We just don't believe that it's a person. Well, now that they'll acknowledge that that baby is human, you know, they keep moving the goalposts. Well, now it's human, but it's not a person. I mean, who came up with this idea that there's a distinction between being a human and being a person? Was this a bioethical issue?
Yeah, well, you know, it was actually in Roe v. Wade. In the Supreme Court decision itself, in the ruling itself, Justice Blackmun, who wrote the decision, said, if you could prove that the fetus is a person, he used the word person, if you could prove that a fetus is a person under the 14th Amendment, then of course its right to life would be guaranteed.
Yeah.
But then he said, however, we do not think it qualifies as a person under the 14th Amendment. So actually the language was there in the Supreme Court ruling,
wow,
right from Roe v. Wade in 1973. It's just taken a while for it to permeate the culture.
Yeah, but I wonder if Justice Blackmun had in view that there was a distinction between a human being and a person. It doesn't seem as many people were speaking that way, the distinction between the human and the person back in the 70s.
That's right. And even today, if you talk to ordinary people as opposed to bioethicists, if you talk to ordinary people, college students, you know, your friends and neighbors, they will often still be talking about, is the fetus really human?
Yeah.
And that's why I have to help people see. We need to help people see that, you know, where the bioethicists are is where the culture is heading.
Yes.
And so we need to understand where the argument is going now is, no, they understand it's fully human. And you'll see this with feminists writing articles, even in popular level magazines. I have several examples in my book, Love Thy Body, of feminists writing and saying, I knew my child was fully a person, fully human, you know, the whole time I was carrying my child, but I would have aborted it at any moment, you know, if it was in my interest to do so.
Wow.
One feminist who says, you must, to defend human rights, like women's rights, you must be prepared to kill.
Oof.
That's a direct quote.
Oof.
So, or another one said, yes, fetus is a human life, but it's a life worth sacrificing.
Oh, that's Moloch
that's
right
the kind
there.
Of language that feminists are using now. They're acknowledging it's fully human.
Yeah.
But saying to defend women's rights, we must be prepared to kill.
Even though half those babies are women, potential.
Yeah, that's where we can show them that they're inconsistent. In fact, not only half the babies, more on a worldwide level, of course, it's more than half, because
yeah,
there's a huge problem with the preferential sex selection abortion.
Right.
In many countries, as you know, India and China, there are now far more baby boys being born than baby girls, because families are practicing sex selection abortion. So not only 50% of the children aborted are girls, but far more. And it's become a social problem in many of these countries. It's driving up sex slavery and prostitution and so on, because there's not enough women for all the men.
That's right. It's horrible to consider. Yeah, I saw an ethicist not too long ago in an interview from Princeton, I believe she was, and she was making the exact argument that you're outlining here, that all you have in the womb when a woman is pregnant is a potential person. And so she was being interviewed and they kept asking these normal questions. Well, then at what point are you not potentially a person? You're a person at 24 weeks. Now they can save babies at 22 weeks. Is that when you become a person? How would you give a coherent Christian response to that question of what it is that makes a person from a biblical worldview? How do we explain to them, no, you're a person from the moment of conception, and here's why?
Right. Well, again, pro-life arguments start with science, because we first establish that life exists. And according to the Christian view, all humans are persons. And one way to think of it is this. The secular view is exclusive. It says some people don't make the cut. Some people are human, but they don't qualify for the status of personhood. They're not good enough. They haven't earned the right to personhood because for the secular person, you have to, the secular bioethicist, it's not enough to be human.
Right.
I mean, let that sink in for a moment. Ugh. To be human is not enough for human rights anymore.
Yeah.
You have to earn the right to legal protection by attaining a certain level of cognitive functioning.
Boy.
The pro-life position is inclusive. It says if you're human, you're in. You're part of the human family. You belong. You're part of what moral ethicists call it, the moral community. That means the group of people for whom we have a moral obligation. If you're human, you're in. So I like to think of it in terms of if you want to use some of the liberal buzzwords, the secular view is exclusive. Because it says some people are not good enough.
Yeah.
The pro-life view is inclusive. It says anyone who's human is a person. We don't make any distinctions.
Great. But couldn't you challenge the secularist who is being exclusive in that regard and say, well, what makes you a person? Is it your size? Is it your ability? Because this is the same crew that often goes in the direction of the culture of death on the opposite end of life, which I want to get to, the euthanasia argument, that when you're no longer useful, now you should get rid of yourself. I mean, there are those who will go that far, that you're a burden on society. You're expensive to maintain. You've lived a long life. We have an overpopulated planet. It's your duty to have death with dignity. So how to challenge them and say, well, what makes you a person who is allowed to live and allowed to thrive? Why you and not a baby?
Right. And you're quite right. The euthanasia argument is exactly the same thing sort of in reverse. It's the same split between being human and being a person. So if bioethicists defend abortion by arguing that anyone who has not achieved a prescribed level of cognitive awareness is not a person, and they turn it around and say euthanasia is okay if you lose certain cognitive abilities because you are no longer a person, even though you're obviously still human.
Right.
And so at that point, you can be unplugged, your treatment can be withheld, your food and water can be discontinued, your organs can be harvested, and you're right, some people are starting to argue now that we should use humans who have cognitive dysfunctions instead of animals for medical research, for example. So that, again, the sheer fact of being biologically human no longer guarantees the most fundamental right, which is the right not to be killed. If you don't have that right, you don't have any of the other rights. You're not living. You can't enjoy any other rights. So the sheer fact of being biologically human. I think one of the ways that we can help people see the enormity of this is just to look at history. History shows us plenty of examples where some group has been labeled as subhuman.
You know what? I want to pick this up on the other side of the break. We'll do that when we come back with Nancy Piercy, her book, Love Thy Body. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. We'll be right back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Preborn. For $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call now, 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-2229 or janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. It's great to have you here and great to be discussing with Nancy Piercy, professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. Her latest book, it's called Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. And Nancy is really delving into some of the most important questions that we're facing as a culture right now that desperately needs to hear the biblical worldview on issues of life and sexuality. So we were talking a little bit about this culture of death, Nancy, before we went to the break. We were talking about abortion and also the flip side, the culture of death as it appears on the end of life, and we're seeing more of this, the death with dignity, physician-assisted suicide. We've seen in Belgium now, it started out, and now the slippery slope has gone down to allowing children to kill themselves and have that kind of self-determination. But what about history? As you mentioned, when we look at history and we look at who ended up being considered subhuman, you know, you think naturally of the Holocaust, but what should we know and learn from history on these issues?
What history shows us clearly is that once a culture abandons the conviction that all humans are created in God's image, then human rights are up for grabs, that any group is fair game to be excluded or eliminated. And you're right, the Holocaust is the most obvious example, but the history of slavery in America is a good one. Lenin in the founding of communism, he called whole categories of people former persons and class enemies, which made it a lot easier to ship them off to concentration camps or simply shoot them. Even the 1994 Rwanda massacre, the Hutus were incited to violence by government radio addresses calling the Tutsis cockroaches, again, implying that they were less than human. And I think it's fascinating to me that there are several secular philosophers who acknowledge that it is Christianity alone that gives a basis for universal human rights. There is a contemporary French philosopher, his name is Luc Ferry, and he wrote a book, surprisingly, promoting atheism, and yet he acknowledged in his book that it was Christianity that introduced the concept of equal rights. He said he says that it overthrew social hierarchies between rich and poor, master and slave, and in fact, here's a quote. He says, Christianity was the first universalist ethos. Or Richard Rorty, who an American philosopher who died not too long ago, who's actually labeled the philosopher of democracy, and yet he said, I have no basis in my secular worldview for universal rights or for democracy. He said it was Christianity alone that gave rise to the concept of universal rights because all humans are created in the image of God. And he said, how did we lose that? He said, because of Darwin. We no longer accept the idea of creation, and therefore we no longer think everyone who is biologically human has equal dignity. So the implication is very clear. Every culture has found somebody to label as less than human, and that has justified excluding them and even eliminating them. And it was Christianity alone that gives the basis for universal human rights, treating everyone with equal dignity.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of people have pointed out the hypocrisy of seeing people who would say, I should have a right to abortion throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. It's my choice, my reproductive freedom. And maybe I'm in favor of euthanasia because death with dignity is an important human right, these sorts of things. But they won't stand up for babies or perhaps the disabled or the elderly at the other end of the spectrum. But these are the same people who will stand firmly for environmentalism, for animals, animal rights, speciesism, standing up against this. What is it that drives people when they deny, not all people obviously, but some people, when they deny inherent human rights because people are created in God's image, they will stand up for animals before they'll stand up for human people?
Yeah, it sounds like it's a, that it contradicts personhood theory, because it sounds like it expresses respect for biological or organic life. But it doesn't. Actually, look at the arguments. The arguments for human rights are just another example of weighing the value of life by instrumental measures like cognitive ability instead of by any kind of intrinsic value. So animal rights activists will say they want to elevate human rights. But what is the logic of their argument? They argue that certain animals, such as dogs or chimps or dolphins, have higher cognitive abilities than some humans. Right. And therefore, those animals should qualify as persons, while, quote-unquote, inferior humans do not qualify as persons.
Wow.
So do you know what they're saying? They're saying all life should be judged by a cognitive ability. So Peter Singer, who's probably, he's an ethicist at Princeton University and probably the best known philosopher of animal rights. And he has argued that the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig or a chimpanzee or a dog.
Yes.
And he's one of the people, for example, who recommends using humans in medical experiments instead of animals if the animals have a higher cognitive capacity. So again, the value of any living thing is measured by its mental function. So the animal rights movement does not contradict personhood theory. It relies on it.
Hmm. That's interesting. You're right about that. That makes a lot of sense. So then when you shift to the sexuality issues, which are so pervasive right now, this is another big part of separating, having this dualistic worldview, as it were, with transgenderism and so forth. What do you make of this next cog in the wheel from the sexual revolution? You talked about the implications we're now seeing coming to fruition, some of the ideals that were planted years ago, Darwinian, you know, worldview and materialism and so forth. Where do you see the LGBT movement going from here? Because we had the Obergefell decision. Now we've redefined marriage by, you know, these five judges who voted in favor of it. Then they immediately moved on to transgenderism. Where is this train heading, do you think?
Let's talk about the political implications. Notice that in each case, the value of biology is being denigrated, and the power of the state is being expanded.
Yeah.
So take abortion. See, in the past, the law recognized the right to life as a pre-political right. It's something you have just because you're a member of the human race.
Right.
And the state doesn't create it. The state merely recognized it. But the only way the state could legalize abortion was to deny the relevance of biology and declare that some humans are not persons. So what was the state doing? It was claiming the right, the authority, to decide arbitrarily which humans qualify for this fundamental right not to be killed. So the state is deciding which humans are really persons. That's a huge increase in the state authority.
Yes.
Instead of just recognizing it, the state is now deciding who qualifies as a person. In the past, the state recognized marriage as a pre-political right. It was based on the fact that humans are a sexually reproducing species. The state didn't invent marriage. The state merely recognized it. But the only way the state could treat same-sex couples the same as opposite-sex couples, as it did in Obergefell, is to deny the relevance of biology and declare that marriage is just an emotional state, an emotional commitment.
Yeah.
But we have all kinds of emotional commitments, right? So the state has claimed the authority to decide arbitrarily which ones qualify as marriage. Again, a huge expansion of state power.
It is. So as God's authority is reduced and diminished, then the state's authority necessarily has risen in order to replace what we naturally saw from a more biblical worldview, it seems.
Right. Instead of recognizing the created order and respecting the created order as something that pre-exists the state is claiming the authority to decide for itself, quite apart from any sort of created order that is given, as all philosophers call it. It's given, meaning it's there, you're supposed to respect it. And let's take the next one. Let's take transgender. The only way, well, obviously, in the past, your gender was seen as something that was determined by your biological sex, you male or female. But the only way that the law can treat a trans woman, that is somebody who's born male, the same as a biological woman, is to deny that biology has any relevance and to declare gender to be a matter of inner feelings.
That's it. We're going to go to another break. Nancy Piercy with us. Her book is Love Thy Body. We'll return right after this on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com, and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. This is Janet Mefford for Preborn. Nearly one in four pregnancies in America will end in abortion. The Ministry of Preborn provides free ultrasounds for abortion-minded women nationwide. When a mother sees her baby on an ultrasound and hears the baby's heartbeat, she's 80% more likely to choose life. Here's a story of a mom who went to one of Preborn's centers and met the baby she had planned to abort.
They took me to the back and they introduced me to my child for the first time through an ultrasound. I was able to see this life growing inside of me, hear the heartbeat, and nothing else mattered at that point. I was a mother to be.
Your gift of $140 will cover the cost of five ultrasounds. All donations are tax deductible. You can help save a baby's life by donating to Preborn. To donate, call now 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. 855-402-2229. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. What a great discussion with Nancy Piercy, professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Baptist University. Her book is called Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality, and it will really help you understand some of these issues that our culture is confronting and why things are so insane. At times, I know we all look at this culture and think, how can you think that way? How can you say that you're a man trapped in a woman's body or vice versa? But this is part of what we were talking about before we went to the break, Nancy, and that is where we've seen in the past a recognition that things were pre-existent and were just recognized, the state, for example, recognizing that marriage exists rather than trying to define it. Now, as you mentioned with the transgender issue, if you're going to reject that your gender and or your sex is based on biology, then you have to invent a new system, right? The state has to get involved in previously inconceivable ways.
Right, exactly. We were talking about how where this is leading, and it's the way it's leading to a huge expansion of state power. So that, to pick up the example we were on with transgenderism, the only way that the law can treat a trans woman who's born male the same as a biological woman is to deny that biology means anything. And that's why you're starting to see the state pass laws, corporations passing policies, schools passing policies, telling us who we must call he or she.
Right.
And the next frontier is parenthood. I've been reading same-sex advocates who are now saying parenthood should no longer be based on biology. Obviously, again, this is something where in the past, the state treated parenthood as something, a pre-political right, something based in biology, the fact that a man and a woman give birth to a baby. But the only way the state can treat opposite sex parents the same as same-sex parents is to deny the relevance of biology. Because in a same-sex couple, at least one of them is not genetically, biologically related to the child.
Right.
Because, you know, same-sex couple obviously cannot both have a child together. And so the only way the state can say, well, your parenthood status is the same as an opposite sex parent is to deny that biology has any relevance and to decide that parenthood will now be based on your emotional commitment, your feelings toward that child, so that you will no longer be considered the parent of your child just because you gave birth to that child, but only at the permission of the state.
Right.
So in all of these issues, pre-political rights are being reduced to merely legal rights that are at the dispensation of the state. And what the state gives, the state can take away.
Yep.
So human rights are no longer inalienable, and the state is acquiring power to micromanage families as as never before.
It's true. And you see what's going on in Canada, that immediately springs to mind, where you're seeing these more and more oppressive decisions coming down about Christian parents may not be able to adopt because they might preach that homosexuality is wrong and these sorts of things. But, you know, I'm wondering what your opinion is on this, Nancy. Do you think that the fact that we are as technologically advanced as we are is part of what fueled the Obergefell decision? In other words, if it had never been possible for us to be able to tinker in a lab with the process of reproduction, do you think that would have taken some of the wind out of the sails of the we can have an alternate family narrative?
Yeah, certainly. Sociologists call it the plausibility structure, which is just another way of saying you can believe something, but if there's not a social structure in place, you can't always live it.
Yeah.
So that we had people way back in the early 19th century arguing for free love, but without the technology of contraception, not very many people could really live out an ideology of free love, because it destroys their lives.
Yes.
Obviously, they're having children outside of marriage, and the society is falling apart. So only a few people were wealthy enough and powerful enough to actually practice an ideology of free love. So it is true that people can work out the logical implications of a secular view of sexuality and so on, but until the technology is there to enable them, most people don't live it out. And that's why contraception, for example, was probably one of the biggest, had the greatest social revolution, because it enabled the sexual revolution that had already happened in people's minds. That's what we have to realize. The worldview had already shifted, but the technology enabled them to live it. So that's a good observation.
It's true, though. So how do Christians respond to all of this? Where do we go with all of this? I know a lot of believers feel very overwhelmed, and they think, I'm just going to hunker down and pray for Jesus to come back very quickly because I'm afraid of what's going to unfold from this worldview in the coming years. But what is your response to all this, and how would you advise Christians to respond in their own lives?
Well, because, like I said a moment ago, the worldview changed first, and the worldview is what we have to address. I'm a member of the I'm a fellow at the Discovery Institute in Seattle, which deals with issues of evolution and intelligent design. Because, like I said at the beginning of the program, it all starts with your view of nature.
Yes.
If you think nature is a product of blind material forces, then you will end up, this is logically inevitable, you will end up with the notion that the human body is just a piece of matter, and it has no higher purpose. It has no moral message for you. It does not give you any clues to your identity. So you can be transgender. You can contradict your own biology, whether that's choosing a gender that's contrary to your biological sex, whether that's choosing a sexual orientation that's contrary to your biological sex, and whether it's an abortion, we're just being biologically human, doesn't matter. You will end up treating the human body as having very little value, worth, or dignity. You have to go back to saying, God created the human being, God created the nature, God created our bodies. And we have to realize we have a certain, we have some barriers in the Christian world, too, that we need to overcome. There is a certain sacred, secular divide in the Christian world that Christians have often had a low view of the body or of life in this world, and the idea that we just wait around to go to heaven.
Right.
We have to make sure that we are addressing our own understandings as well, that in a Christian worldview, we need to have a high view of the body as God's handiwork, as, like I said before, the incarnation. The incarnation is an ultimate affirmation of the dignity of the body. And the fact that heaven is not a place where we're going to be in wispy little wispy spirits, floating about, but that the ultimate goal is the new heavens and a new earth, and we will be there in the resurrected bodies.
Right.
We need to also make sure we have a biblical understanding of the value, dignity, and worth of the body within a Christian worldview.
So true. I can't even think of a time where I've ever heard a sermon on the importance of understanding we will get our bodies back. And how much of a difference that will make if we really stress that we will be resurrected and our bodies and our souls will be reunited, that it's not just we're going to be these ethereal spirits floating around. Because I do think a lot of Christians have a misunderstanding of that and end up maybe unwittingly denigrating the body in their own worldview because they've never heard much about the truth.
I'm getting that a lot from people who have read the book who are saying, I expect you to get some handy answers to the secular view, and instead, or in addition, I'm finding that I'm challenged. I'm being challenged by my understanding of the body.
Good.
In Philippians, when Paul says that we're citizens of heaven, people think that means my true citizen, my true home is in heaven, and I'm supposed to sort of wait around hoping, being thankful for the day when I'm going to leave this world and go to heaven. That's not what it meant. Philippians was a Roman colony. The purpose of a Roman colony was to Romanize the surrounding area, was to bring Roman culture to that surrounding area. So they were citizens of Rome, meant that they were supposed to penetrate that Greek culture with Roman culture. So when Paul says you're citizens of heaven, his point is you are supposed to be permeating your existing world, your culture, with a heavenly culture. He didn't mean you're supposed to want to go away, be whisked away to heaven. His point was that you're supposed to be advocates for a biblical worldview within your culture. Most of us have this backwards. So it's things like that where we have to recognize our calling is to permeate our current world with a biblical understanding. I went to a church once where every other sentence was, we're so thankful we're going to go to heaven. We can have the hope that we're going to heaven. Our sins are forgiven so we can go to heaven.
Yeah.
And I thought, wait a minute, that's not the biblical, that's more Gnostic.
Yes.
You used that word earlier.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, the name of the book is Love Thy Body. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but Nancy Piercy, just such a delight to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, God bless you. This hour, Janet Mefford Today, brought to you by Preborn. For a gift of $140, you can provide ultrasounds to 5 women in crisis pregnancies. Call 855-601-BABY, 855-601-2229, or preborn.com. God bless you. We'll see you next time.